This is The Beautiful Game.
Is this the opener? Yes, it is! That's what they came to see! The name is Messi.
Vinicius Junior is in here, and it's two.
Modric. Now he'll unleash one! Sensational goal!
Mbappe, Griezmann, Pogba! It is France. It will be some can-can on the Champs-Élysées tonight.
So we'll hook that cross in. Pulisic! Oh, lovely hat-trick! What a night!
Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Beautiful Game. I'm your host, Alex Hardy, and I will be your guide throughout the 2022 World Cup in Qatar. I'm thrilled to bring back this podcast after it lay dormant for 8 years, just something I've been excited to do, and more importantly, to keep everyone informed on the world's favorite game, the beautiful game of soccer. I have to be honest with you, this is my favorite sporting event, period, but it does come with some concern for me. I feel conflicted. It's something that I've always enjoyed. I remember being a young kid watching the World Cup for the very first time, and now you fast forward to being an adult and understanding that there's complexity in a sport that I love watching so much, but at the same time take issue with the organization of FIFA as well as the host site of Qatar. So I felt like spending just a moment or two discussing a few of the issues that I take, knowing full well you can always refer back to what I mentioned here as we move forward. And genuinely, I just, before getting this podcast officially started, I thought it was worth looking back on how Qatar won this World Cup, and more importantly, moving forward, the three specific issues that I take with this World Cup and why it caused a bit of an internal conflict for me personally. It's just how I feel, because truly, as I'm watching these games, it's hard to remove, again, these three specific tenets of issue that I take with the FIFA 2022 World Cup in Qatar. It has to begin with FIFA's bribery and corruption that landed this bid in Qatar. More than a dozen FIFA officials that cast a vote in handing Qatar this World Cup bid have since been banned from FIFA due to allegations or convictions of fraud and corruption. Sepp Blatter, the former FIFA president himself, admitted that it was a mistake handing Qatar this World Cup. And yes, there are human rights violations that are worth mentioning, but the logistics, I'm talking to you right now as a World Cup is being held 6 months out of its regular cycle because the nation itself cannot support a World Cup in its regular window because those summer heats in Qatar reach in excess of 125, 130 degrees Fahrenheit. And until they were told otherwise, they believed that they could have millions of people flock to their country to hold a World Cup in that type of heat. And it was just completely unrealistic. So now we have a 2-month break of the regular professional soccer seasons. The Premier League is a perfect example. England's league, which represents a large number of players competing in this World Cup, typically that season ends and there's a 31-day rest period between the end of the regular season and the start of the World Cup. Now, because of this altered schedule, there were 7 days between when the World Cup began following the Premier League taking a break. It's just unconscionable to expect players to be as prepared as they would be in previous cycles, knowing full well they're in the throes of a season, and as soon as this World Cup is over, they'll be going back to competing again where they make their money, playing in professional soccer leagues. So the actual logistics of the World Cup is unlike any other, and it is the complete result of bribery, of corruption that took place amongst FIFA leaders, many of whom have since been removed. So with the first logistical piece out of the way, two separate human rights violations, I believe, exist not only within the nation of Qatar, their belief and policy criminalizing sex outside of marriage, as well as criminalizing homosexuality, providing jail sentences for homosexuals and victims of rape, the same as they would anyone else committing a crime, sometimes worse, is an issue that I take specifically with the nation of Qatar and the human rights violations that occurred as a result of building this $220 billion World Cup site. You're talking about a reported 6,500 migrant workers who were killed trying to create this World Cup, and FIFA and the nation of Qatar will contend that only 3 of those workers died on the job. Only 37 more had non-related deaths. But the reality is these families have lost their loved ones. They're trying to provide as best as they can. And while there is money to be had in Qatar, it comes with serious risks and countless stories of passports being stolen, of people being held hostage because this nation is hell-bent on hosting the World Cup when logistically it doesn't make sense, when the law of the land doesn't make sense to me, as well as the human rights violations that occurred as they were trying to build the beautiful game in the nation of Qatar. It's not as if they aren't allowed to have a passion for the sport, to grow the game, but when this World Cup and every World Cup is supposed to represent the good of the sport, the growth of the game, and the healthy obsession with supporting your nation, having this here in Qatar just seems to spit in the face of it, spit in the face of all that can be good with the game of soccer. With that being said, the 32 best teams in the world should be in Qatar right now. You've got 31 of them in Qatar, which ranks 50th in the world at the time of the beginning of the World Cup. But with all of that being said, I have a passion for this game that made me want to share it with you. And so without further ado, this is The Beautiful Game. On today's Beautiful Game, we've got group play. This is The Beautiful Game, coming to you on a Tuesday evening following day 3 of the World Cup, the first installment of The Beautiful Game 2022 Qatar World Cup. No better time than today because we pick up right where we left off in 2018, where France, after hoisting the trophy, looks just as good, even if they aren't as strong as they were 4 years ago. Let's start with Kyle Mbappe, who finally gets his goal after sailing that first chance over the crossbar when they were trailing Australia, this being a 4-1 final. We come to Mbappe after being the youngest player to score in a World Cup for France 4 years ago. He lit the world stage on fire as a teenager, but he did not follow up that type of hype that he built for the Euro 2020 campaign, proving that he was among the best in the world. He didn't score throughout that tournament and even threatened to quit the national team after receiving backlash for that underwhelming performance. So I'll get into how he played along with the rest of the reigning World Cup champions, but it's important to start with who isn't there. Mbappe showed up. I mentioned that he was threatening to quit the national team, but it kind of seems like that's where we are with the reigning Ballon d'Or champion, Karim Benzema. It's a weird exit that puts a spotlight on a number of French injuries. This, according to multiple reports, France's medical team had doubts about how transparent Benzema was about his health after he picked up a thigh injury in October with Madrid and then a separate hamstring injury during the Champions League. This, of course, being one of the best strikers in the world, the Ballon d'Or championship, usually reserved for the likes of Lionel Messi or Cristiano Ronaldo. But Benzema proving he is among one of the best clinical finishers in the world, a complete forward, and a huge loss for France. And the odd thing was that after he arrived in Qatar earlier this week, he since took the flight home on Saturday to Madrid right before the first games got underway. Manager Didier Deschamps is keeping the roster at 25, saying he didn't want to interrupt the other Parisians' vacations while professional leagues are on break. So not only are they down Benzema, but let's get into this 4-1 match with Australia. Right after, we watch Craig Goodwin with that screamer in the top shelf, right where Mama keeps that cookie jar. In the 11th minute, Lucas Hernandez in the midfield goes down, and we're wondering if Deschamps is going to trim the roster again if Hernandez is unavailable. He set the precedent that France may be 2 men down for the remainder of the tournament. So it's definitely something to keep an eye on with the number of injuries coming into this tournament. They're missing Paul Pogba, N'Golo Kanté, which leaves France vulnerable both at striker and center back. So, with France down at least one player, leave it to the old stalwart, Olivier Giroud, to step up, scoring the brace, two goals against Australia, and he took over for Benzema, this being now his third World Cup appearance. The two goals today were two more than he had in all of the 2018 World Cup title run, and he's now officially matched Thierry Henry's record, 51 goals for the French national team. Credit Giroud, who uses combination of size and speed, the perfect target man, coveted not only by France, but spent the last two decades playing in the top leagues across the world, France, the Premier League, and now featured for Milan. Giroud found the back of the net, but Kylian Mbappe and Adrien Rabiot were the engines that power the French locomotive. They each scored goals of their own, but in particular, you watch that match, Rabiot was one of the best players in Italy this year after joining Juventus over the summer, and that form certainly continued for this first game, not only heading in the equalizer against Australia, but he was right there in support, helping the offense build their possessions while also being a nightmare for the Australian defenders. With that victory, France goes on to face Tunisia, with a win essentially locking them in for the knockout round. Denmark and Tunisia earlier today ended in a 0-0 draw, which is expected based on the possession-heavy type of game that the Danes particularly like to play. But I mention this to say that there were actually a combined 24 shots on goal, 15 of them coming off corners, which is the most for a scoreless draw within the last two World Cups. And really, things took a turn in the final minutes, the 94th minute. There was a no call on a potential handball that could have led to a dramatic penalty kick for Denmark, but instead, we get the first 0-0 draw of the day. And before moving on, it's fantastic, just wonderful news seeing Christian Eriksen back on the world's greatest stage. When we saw him for the 2020 Euros, his heart stopped in the middle of play, had to be stretchered off the field, and he truly wondered in that moment if he was about to lose his life. So Christian Eriksen, one of the best midfielders in the Premier League, and now showing up for Denmark as they hold strong and make sure that they can not fall too far behind France, who, of course, has those 3 points. Now let's go over to Group C, where Mexican and Poland gave us the second 0-0 draw of the day, but it was Saudi Arabia that pulled off the stunning upset over Lionel Messi and Argentina. So we'll start with the first match of the day. I went to bed around 1:15 this morning, and man, I was thinking to myself, what if I just stay up another hour? What if in 45 minutes, I can see Lionel Messi for the 2022 debut, and he delivered. I should have stayed up because within the first 10 minutes, here he is putting Argentina up 1-0 on the PK. But at that point, there's 80 minutes left in that match plus stoppage time. Who would have expected Saudi Arabia to not only equalize, but to come away with the 3 points in the 2-1 victory? The Saudis not only took the lead in Group C, but they broke up Argentina's 36-match unbeaten streak, which was one game shy from beating Italy's longest unbeaten streak in international football history. We're just talking complete dominance and ultimately completely unexpected results when Argentina ranks second in the world, I believe, third in the world, and Saudi Arabia even below Qatar in the 50s. What there is to say is that no matter how far this team makes the tournament, they could lose to Mexico and Poland and never make it out of the group stage. But we had our one shining moment from Saudi Arabia. The second goal in the, they had the back-to-back goals within 10 minutes of each other. There was a screamer from Salem Al-Dasari, 2-1. Go-ahead goal. Not only the goal itself, but the backflip celebration was something that we will be seeing for the remainder of the tournament, and it's truly one of the great moments in World Cup history at the expense of Lionel Messi. He said after the match there was absolutely no excuse for the way that they performed, and maybe we've awoken a sleeping giant in Argentina. A criticism of Lionel Messi is his performance on the international stage for all the success he's had at Barcelona and now Paris Saint-Germain. There's no way to believe that he's going to go down lying along with an incredibly talented Argentina. What there is to say, getting back to the 0-0 draw between Poland and Mexico, which really opened things wide, knowing full well that Saudi Arabia is now leading Group C as the lone victors, but 1 point each for both Poland and Mexico, and Honestly, it comes down to the PK. What is there to say when you have Robert Lewandowski and Memo Ochoa? Ochoa still has the magic left in him. You have that unstoppable force in Robert Lewandowski, one of the most successful and celebrated scorers, who's been the captain and Poland's all-time leading scorer for more than a decade at this point, and he's still searching for his first World Cup goal. There he is on the penalty line, and on the other side, you have the immovable object in Memo Ochoa. He's appearing in his fifth World Cup as Mexico's keeper, and after playing two decades in the top professional leagues across the world, he's returned to the first team he's ever played for just a few years ago. They play at Estadio Azteca. He puts on a much better show than Colt McCoy does on Monday Night Football, and it seems like this is Memo's moment. Ochoa essentially disappears into obscurity for 4 years, and then he just pops up in the World Cup with an incredible highlight save, this time coming against Lewandowski, again, one of the most celebrated scorers of our lifetime, and denying that penalty kick, which would have given Poland a clear victory. So again, the point goes to the immovable object against that unstoppable force. It was a thrilling set of games that we had for Tuesday, but I'd be remiss not to circle back to Monday's action, including Team USA, which we'll get to. There was a more decisive victory, none more than England and the Netherlands, each with their own convincing victories. We've got a lot to look forward to with England-USA this Friday, but I'm going to tell you that in England's first match, that 6-2 scoreline, I think, is a bit of a misnomer. Iran's starting goalkeeper was injured 19 minutes into the match, and after being taken off on the stretcher, England was able to take advantage with their dominant attack. Both Saka's brace, the two goals, plus Rashford and Jack Grealish coming off the bench to score those goals. And shout out Jack Grealish. Not only did he net the sixth and final goal for England, but I talked about the celebration with Saudi Arabia. If you were making fun of Jack Grealish for kind of waving his arms around, it turns out he was filling the request of a young boy with cerebral palsy who asked Jack that if you score a goal, could you do this celebration for me? It's an incredible gesture that Grealish had made. He's long been a supporter of endeavors to empower and take care of children suffering cerebral palsy in particular. His sister lives with that. And so he's spent this time throughout his professional career visiting kids in hospitals around England. And for that, I say, good lad, Jack Grealish. Good lad. Meanwhile, with the Dutch in their own victory, 2-0 over Senegal, after finishing third in the 2014 World Cup, the Dutch are hoping to make up for lost time after failing to qualify for 2018. And as I'm about to discuss with the U.S., there's a lot that can happen after missing the World Cup 4 years ago, because you have a completely different roster when you move on from the last cycle they were in 8 years ago. Long gone are the iconic attackers like RVP, Iron Robin, Wesley Sneijder, Klaas-Jens Huntelaar, and that headhunter Nigel de Jong. So where do we find the Dutch attack for 2022? Memphis Depay and Frankie de Jong, the Barcelona teammates, were the big question marks in terms of their health ahead of this World Cup. So, with that in mind, the expectations were sky high for Cody Gakpo, who delivered with the go-ahead hitter in that 84th minute. Against the likes of Senegal, Qatar, and hopefully Ecuador to round up Group A, one or two goals might be all they need with the support and the leadership in that back line, Virgil van Dijk and Nathaniel Ake. With Jurrien Timber serving as the most exciting talent on defense, plus the veteran stalwart of Stefan de Rijs, both available coming off the bench, this Dutch team will be one of the hardest to stop as long as they get an opening lead. But before getting to the U.S. opening match, we have to start with the first game of the tournament, Group A. Just a shout out, a swan song performance for one of Ecuador's greatest players. Since debuting for Ecuador over a decade ago, Ener Valencia, the all-time leading goal scorer, added to his record World Cup tally 5 goals in 4 games for Ecuador. And previously mentioning those concerns I have with Qatar, it'd be kind of nice for them to have a short outing exiting group play. And that brings us to the United States and all the concerns that we have after that 1-1 draw, falling victim to Gareth Bale's equalizing penalty kick. As I mentioned with the Dutch, it's been 8 years since our last World Cup appearance, and it's been a world of difference with the types of players we have on this roster and where they've been able to compete on the world's biggest stages. So is this moment too big? Is this World Cup too big for these players, or is it too big for the manager, Greg Berhalter? Walker Zimmerman and the U.S. backline with Tim Ream, Anthony Robinson, and Sergiño Dest is among this country has ever produced for the World Cup. And one bad decision by Zimmerman to go in for that slide tackle in the box, taking out Gareth Bale and setting up that PK, unfortunately has to define how this team, how that defense played, despite the fact that for the rest of the match prior, they were absolutely dominant. And let's get to the offense. Clearly, the second half was the bigger issue, but let's focus on the bright side. In the 36th minute, that counterattack proved it could be lethal. Christian Pulisic delivered on the hype as our number 10, our center forward. He found open space, delivered a beautiful touch pass for Tim Weah, and we had that 1-0 lead. And one more moment on that goal. This is about Josh Sargent, who's been a revelation for Norwich City in the Premier League this year. Stu Holden on the Fox broadcast pointed this out right away, and he would know, considering his 25 caps with Team USA, that by coming out of position, Sargent takes this ball and runs toward midfield. He drew in the Welsh center backs with him, which created all the space and enough daylight for Pulisic to take that ball from Sargent and deliver it upfield. Again, this isn't going to show up on the stat sheet, but that assist to the assist by Sargent is the type of play that really has me excited for Team USA. And we have so many exciting players. We have the third youngest roster in the World Cup, the likes of Weah, Sargent, Weston McKennie, but we've also maintained our ability to lose every single lead we get. This has been typical of Team USA, and despite all of that success that we've had, at least up to the first 36 minutes, maybe the first half, it happened again. We've got standout performances from the likes of Tyler Adams or Musa, the first ever U.S. teenager to start a World Cup match, and yet we continue to play for a draw instead of going after those 3 points. Berthaler's decision to leave Ricardo Pepi off the roster was a bit of a warning sign. I'm not going to make too much of a big deal of this, but again, he scored 3 goals in World Cup qualifying, was a glaring omission for our attack, and now we get to the controversy surrounding the exclusion of Giovanni Reyna for Game 1 against Wales. Reyna has been one of the best players performing internationally, starting regularly for Borussia Dortmund in the Bundesliga, and once dubbed the American Dream by Erling Haaland, who right now is currently on pace to break Lionel Messi's single-season scoring record, both professional and international, for a single season. It's just one man's opinion, but I'll stand by Haaland's credibility. Norway can't make the World Cup. It's been a long time for them, so he's watching from the sidelines. When we talk about Reyna, he had sustained the hamstring injury during U.S. qualifying, but returned to play for Dortmund before exiting for Qatar. He told reporters before the tournament he was 100% and yet excluded not only from the starting lineup, but was also subbed in, with 2 strikers coming in ahead of him, including Jordan Morris in the 88th minute. This is not about putting down Jordan Morris. This is the 88th minute, and the game might not change at all when there's only 10 minutes left, but Jordan Morris is the type of player that represents the old guard in U.S. men's national team philosophy. The stories of Clint Dempsey and Landon Donovan having to take hour-long bus rides across Texas and California and all over the country just to find adequate competition are long gone. Jordan Morris is one of the most accomplished collegiate soccer players here in the U.S., scoring goal after goal at Stanford before being selected in the MLS draft, going to his hometown Seattle Sounders. It's a wonderful story. He's a hero in the MLS, but the reality is that Gio Reyna, who again, according to him, says he's healthy, at 20 years old today, has already been scoring goals in the Bundesliga for 3 seasons. He's accomplished more professionally and should have been in that game for the U.S. to at least get their attack back on track when they were lethargic to opening the second half. The future of U.S. soccer is relying on our world-class athleticism and competing to win instead of settling for the draw. So that brings me to Black Friday, the fixture ahead with England. And our midfielders are going to be put to a huge test. I mentioned Tyler Adams, Musa, both played outstanding against Wales, but controlling the pace of this game will be absolutely critical for the U.S. And with the help of the fullbacks, Anthony Robinson and Sergiño Dest, plus DeAndre Yedlin when he came off the bench against Wales, they knew when to provide pressure in that first game. But the last thing they can afford to do is to be caught out of position against England's attack. Six goals against Iran, and Harry Kane had none of them. Expect him to step up for the Three Lions and provide a size disparity that caused a problem against Wales as soon as they subbed in the 6'6" Kiefer Moore for that second half. It caught the U.S. off guard. They didn't adjust, but hopefully they've had a plan in place for Harry Kane because, again, he's so big, he's so dominant, it's impossible to miss him. And besides, we've got history to defend. The U.S. has never lost to England, not only in the World Cup, but also in every revolutionary war. But the statistics bear out that at least in 1999 with the 1-1 draw and the historic 1-0 victory over England in the 1950 World Cup, these guys have not beaten us, and I'm not ready for that to start. But before we get to Friday, just a quick look at the Thursday matchups. I couldn't be more excited for a number of European powers that will be on display. I haven't seen it anywhere else, so I will personally dub Group E the Group of Death, with Germany and Spain headlining along with Costa Rica, honestly one of my favorite teams. Joel Campbell, Claudio Bravo, two guys absolutely worth keeping your eye on, Bravo being one of the best goalies in the entire field, plus Japan, who I'm also excited to look forward to. You've got Belgium taking on Alphonso Davies, who is the best player from North America, Canada. That'll be exciting. And you've got the 2018 runner-up Croatia, featuring what could be the last World Cup appearance for Luka Modric against Morocco. So Thursday's got plenty in store, but you'll hear from me Friday after USA-England right here on your favorite World Cup podcast for Qatar 2022, this is The Beautiful Game.